Up next from Stanford Social Innovation Review, Doug Hadaway, President Hadaway Communications. Hadaway shows how nonprofits can rise above the noise and connect with people in meaningful ways using the power of aspirational narrative. Hadaway discusses the art and science of communicating with maximum motivating power using practical tools and techniques adapted from psychology, linguistics, literature, and marketing on Social Innovation Conversations.
Hi, I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're excited to bring you another presentation in the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems.
And now, here is our presentation.
My name is Michael Slind. I'm the senior editor at Stanford Social Innovation Review. I've been there a little less than half a year, and this is my first chance to attend the Nonprofit Management Institute. I'm having a great time. I'm learning a great deal. I'm very excited to be here with you. I'm also excited to be introducing our next presenter, Doug Hadaway. Doug is the president of Hadaway Communications, a firm that works with organizations and their leaders to help them, quote, achieve ambitious goals for people and the planet. I got that phrase from the website of Doug's company. Here's another line there that I kind of like. He says, we're in the business of communications for impact, not self-promotion. As a communication professional myself, I think it's a very nice way of putting it. And certainly, Doug has experience in communicating with impact in a very big way. I first encountered Doug, if encountered is the right term, as a face on my television screen, and you might have seen him on your TV screen too. He was, and occasionally he still is, a talking head, one of those people who appear on political chat shows to speak on behalf of an elected official or a political candidate. In 2000, in fact, he was the national spokesman for the Al Gore for President campaign, and he was the chief spokesman for Al Gore during the tumultuous Florida recount process that followed. Afterward, he worked with Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle as his spokesman. In 2008, Doug contributed to the presidential campaign of Hillary Clinton. But consulting for and speaking for prominent political figures is only one role that Doug has played as a strategic communicator. Like many of the presenters we've had here the last day and a half, and like many of you, he's really a multi-sector threat. He has clients in the field, not just of politics and government, but also in the for-profit business field and the field of nonprofit leadership. He has consulted, for example, to CARE, to the Human Rights Campaign, to the Gates and Ford Foundations, and to multiple other mission-driven organizations. Today, Doug is here not as a talking head, but as a fully embodied thought leader in the field of helping organizations, people in organizations, in nonprofit organizations in particular, to tell their story in ways that mobilize and motivate all their stakeholders. Please welcome Doug Hadaway.
Thank you very much, Michael. You know, you have to be a real political junkie to know who I am. Do you know the one thing that surveys show that many Americans fear more than death itself? Public speaking. And it's especially terrifying to be the first speaker after lunch. Because according to the studies of our body's natural rhythms, you should all really be taking a nap right now. So I shall endeavor to keep you awake, but also engaged in learning tools and techniques and theories that you can use to inspire and engage people for your cause. And we're going to be getting hands-on with that as we move along. Let's dive right into it. How many of you recognize this symbol? Wow, that's good. You've probably seen it worn by people on their clothes, posted on their Facebook pages. I've seen it at rallies in New York City and on the bumpers of pickup trucks in Arkansas. You probably know it as the equal sign. It's the icon of the movement for equality for gay and lesbian people here in America. And it began as the logo of a nonprofit organization, the Human Rights Campaign. I first worked with that organization in the mid-1990s. It began as a behind-the-scenes inside the Beltway, very quiet lobbying organization, gave money to politicians to try to get a voice at the table. It had an annual budget at the time of about $8 million and about 100,000 members. And it had a very modest agenda. This was considered a third rail in politics, and politicians did not want to touch it. The idea that Americans would support marriage equality for gay and lesbian people was just a pipe dream. People didn't think it would happen in our lifetimes. Then a new leader came in who had actually come from Apple Computers. He's been in senior management at Apple. And Apple knows something about building a brand, as we call it, that people embrace, literally as part of their identity. How many people in the room are Mac people? Whoa, I knew this was a hip crowd. Now, are you ever gonna switch to a PC? It ain't gonna happen, right? That's a relationship that you have. It goes beyond the functions. We're gonna talk about this. It goes beyond the functions of that computer. Nothing, we're not putting down the PC people, right? There's a relationship there that goes beyond what that thing does. It's a relationship, it's part of your identity. The leader that we had, the Human Rights Campaign, coming from Apple, understood the power of that kind of relationship that you can create between an organization and its stakeholders, between a brand and its customers. She set ambitious goals for growing the organization and its membership and advancing the agenda. And she wanted a new message and a new image. So to create it, we began by speaking to our own members. We started not with expensive market research, going out in the world trying to find people who never heard of us. We started with the people who already did. And we asked the most important question you can ask of people about your organization. And guess what? The question is not about your organization. It's about them. It's about the people that you are trying to get involved in your organization. And you start by asking them, what are your hopes for your life? When you let yourself dream a little, what is it that you see in the future? When you understand what people are striving for in their lives, you can figure out what your organization can do to help them achieve that, to help them be the kind of person they want to be, to help them live in the kind of community or country that they want to live in. When you connect your organization to people's aspirations, you can create those meaningful, lasting relationships that expand your reach to new people, that expand your resources, and enhance your impact. So this symbol represents the aspirations of Human Rights Campaign members who we talked to in the mid-1990s when we asked them, what are your aspirations? The big idea that motivated them was simple, but it was very powerful. They wanted to be treated equally. They just want to be treated like anybody else. They want to be safe and open, and live in their communities, at work, and at home, just like anybody else did, without living in fear of discrimination or violence. And today, that nonprofit symbol is a symbol of a movement that's on the rise. Its issues are on the top of the national agenda. Just recently, support for marriage equality in America went over 50%. It's jumping by 5 points a year. That's the fastest growth in support for a social issue in recent American history. And the Human Rights Campaign today has a budget of $38 million and almost 2 million members. And leaders of nonprofits often ask me, how has that movement done what they're doing? It's really an example of success today in such a short period of time. There's a lot to that answer. But today we're going to start where it all began with what I call aspirational communication. So I wanted to say a little bit more. Michael said a little bit about our firm. I want to say a little bit more about us so you know where we're coming from. We do have a mission just like you. Our mission is to help visionary leaders and organizations achieve ambitious goals that benefit people on the planet. We work with clients in politics and government. I knew early on, my first job out of college, I went to journalism school, undergrad. My first job out of college was for a member of Congress, and I knew right away I was not going to work for politicians the rest of my life. But there are a lot of people in politics who are mission-driven. We work with most of the world's top foundations and nonprofit organizations in many different fields here and abroad, as well as social enterprises and businesses with a social purpose, and that's a really exciting area now. Particularly young people, the millennial generation, the largest generation in our history. We do a lot of studies on them. They are really motivated for purpose in their lives, and they see business and entrepreneurial activity as a way to make a difference in their world. So there's a very exciting future ahead if you can think like that. So to achieve great things, leaders know that you have to motivate and mobilize people. There is an art and a science to that. That's what we're going to talk about right now. So what you learned today, theories and tools you can use to communicate with maximum motivating power. Now we draw on approaches used by the world's greatest brands like Apple, on our experience in politics and advocacy, on the science of social and cognitive psychology, linguistics, also anthropology, as well as the art of literature, even poetry. We're going to talk about some of these theories and tools today, and as we go, I'll ask you about applying them to your issue, and you have in your book, if you've got open, you'll have, we've given you space there to make notes as we go along. The idea is that you leave with some ideas. I think it's going to start your thinking maybe in a new direction. I don't think we're going to hit any great breakthroughs or decisions for you today, but walk out, I hope, with some new food for thought to think about how to communicate in a new way about your organization. So here's a rule of thumb to think about when you're thinking about strategic communications and investing time and resources in communications for your organization. Communications can be held accountable for achieving three things, and they're all three are measurable. You can raise awareness about your issue or your cause, you can change people's attitudes about it, and you can motivate them to take action. This approach we're going to talk about is designed to do all three things. Ultimately, if people don't take action, I think you're wasting a lot of your time and money. Right? We want to get people to that. So it's a high bar we've set. But let's look for inspiration. So we recently marked the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. 200,000 people gathered on the Mall in Washington that day in 1968. Many of them went on, as you know, to put their lives on the line, fighting the evils of segregation and discrimination. They changed hearts and minds in Washington and across the country. It led to major civil rights laws. It led to a sea change in our society. Dr. King was one of the most successful movement leaders in our time. Why is that? I submit it's because he inspired people. His words and his deeds moved people to take courageous action in the face of often brutal opposition. Few of us have his gift for evocative language or inspirational leadership, but fortunately we can learn to emulate it. Beginning with its very title, I Have a Dream, right? That's all about aspirations. Every line paints a picture of the future, and not just an end to discrimination, but he was talking about an era of harmony. He was painting the vision of a future he really wanted to live in, not just the absence of the evil, but a whole new reality. So my team, we have a research team who analyze the public dialogue on issues. We do what's called content analysis to understand what's happening in content that motivates people. We did an analysis of that speech. It showed that aspirational emotional language counted for 80% of the content of that speech. What we call functional language, in this case talking about the policies that they wanted to pass, about 5% of that speech. Now, this comes as no surprise to people who study motivation. People's decisions or behavior are really driven by their desires for their future. Hope is what gets people out of bed in the morning. It's what keeps you going through the toughest times, even when your promised land seems like it could be a long way off. That's what I Have a Dream did for the civil rights movement. I think that's what you can do for your cause as well. So let's see, start to look at the science behind that sort of thing. This image unpacks a number of the theories from psychology that we use and that you can use to communicate with maximum motivating power. It says that you have to connect with people on multiple levels. If you do that, you'll get higher levels of engagement, as that said, more people wanting to get involved, wanting to learn more and take action. So let's start with that aspirational level at the first one. It says that's their hopes and values. Now, your hopes, think about that. Your hopes are a product of your imagination, right? You picture the future you desire. That's why an effective vision statement for an organization literally allows people to see the future that you're working toward. That's what a vision is all about. That's what aspirations are all about. Values are closely related, but it's different. Values are a preference that you have for the way the world should be and shouldn't be. So value statements are often stated as what's right and what's wrong. What's you believe what's right, you believe what's wrong. A lot of you, I'm sure, are motivated in your work because what you're working on, rights or wrong, that sort of thing. Those are value statements. You want to talk about both. Then the emotional or the social level here is the next level. This is a really important one. Psychologists have a term called social proof. It says that when we are looking to understand something, wrap our head around an issue, get involved in a cause, figure out who to vote for, that sort of thing, when we're trying to figure out how to think or behave, we look to other people who we perceive to be in our social circles, people we think are like us, or people who we aspire to be like. We look to them for what the psychologists call social cues as to how, literally, how to think and behave. There's interesting studies on this in marketing. About 10% of consumers are the people who everybody else turns to for where to shop and what's a hot place to eat and what to buy, that sort of thing. That's a very powerful dynamic. So when people are thinking about getting involved in your organization, they're often trying to picture who's already there. What team am I joining here? We're going to talk about the importance of putting your people in the picture when you talk about your organization. The emotional, very important. Emotion works with cognition to help us with attention and retention and motivation. So when you communicate, your communications have to create emotional reactions. Emotions are a physiological reaction, right? You can measure it. You feel it in your gut. It's something happening to your body. If you don't, people aren't going to notice it, much less remember it, much less be moved to act. So we have to speak to their heart as well as their head. Then there's the functional. This is the information about what your organization does, right? The function of it. Lots of nonprofits talk about their functions in terms of their programs. Oh, we got this program over here, this program over there. Often we tend to want to explain people how we're organized, right? The way you want to talk about what you do is talk about it as solutions to problems. We'll talk about that in a minute. And always put in the foreground, what are the benefits to people of those solutions that you bring to the table? So let me give you an example out of politics about thinking aspirationally. I was working with members of the US Senate who wanted to shore up public support for Social Security. The clients I work with are Democrats, and they love to talk about Social Security as a safety net. So the way to think aspirational, take the topic, Social Security, what does it have to do with your life? That's retirement. How many people aspire to be caught in a government safety net when they retire? Right? That's not aspirational. In fact, what the studies show on people's feelings about retirement, most people imagine themselves traveling, seeing the world, doing those things they never got to do. Travel is the number one thing that people say, even if it's not going to happen, right? Knock on wood, we have money to go travel when we're seniors, right? But that's the way people are thinking about retirement. They're not thinking about landing in safety nets. And people see Social Security as something they've earned. It's not a handout, it's not a safety net from the government they give you. People feel they have earned it through a lifetime of work. That's aspirational thinking. That's the way people like to think of themselves. Let's take another example from the world of consumer products where this thinking really started. Think of jeans, pair of jeans. So what is the function of a pair of jeans? It's to cover the lower half of your body. Literally, what does it do? It covers the lower half of your body, right? So my brand is denim riveted together. You could get that for less than $20, right? People are spending $200, $300 for a pair of jeans. You know who you are. There is something going on there when we'll pay that for, you know, denim riveted together. So my understanding of this comes from middle school when I adopted my favorite brand. I was in middle school and I aspired to be cool, right? And believe me, that was tough. I was quite the dork in middle school. But it was the most important thing in the world to me. I wanted to fit in. That's the social dimension, right? And that's a very important motivator that time of your life. And your motivations change. Hopefully, as we grow and mature, our motivations change. So I looked at my peers for those social cues that the psychologists say. And in my middle school, it was a little orange tag on your behind, right? Everybody was wearing that brand. That was a badge of fitting in and being cool. I see people like orange tag. You'll see. Having that brand of jeans with that little tag on my backside, that made me fill in. That made me feel better about myself. And I walked down the halls of Westlake Middle School with my head held a little higher. The marketers call that an emotional benefit. I got emotional benefit from wearing that pair of jeans. So all of those dynamics are what led me to drag my poor mother to the Levi's section of the department store, where the last step in the process was she looks at the price tag. Yeah. right? That's the last step in the process. Even in the realm of economic activity, where we are deciding how to spend our hard-earned money, we do not start with rational, you know, cost-benefit analyses. We start with our hopes and aspirations. I tell these examples like, it's important to start thinking this way because this is how people are motivated to do all sorts of things. It's not just dorky kids in middle school. We do it throughout our lives. So let's take a look at some examples from the nonprofit world. Ford Foundation. Ford asked us to update their 70-year-old brand. This is a few years ago. They had new leadership, a new strategy. They wanted a new message. So we started the process of developing a message and strategy by asking three simple questions. These are three critical questions you always want to ask when you're starting to strategize about communications, right? The first one is, who is the audience? Now, the strategic way to answer that question is, who can help me achieve my goal? Lots of nonprofits, when we ask who's your audience, they say the public. They say everybody. It's not. Your priority audiences, when you're putting your strategic hat on, are the people who can help you achieve your goals. The second question flows quite logically from that. What can they do for you? Be very specific about what can they do for you. There's lots of ways to think about that. We all start with, they can give us money. Of course they can. They can give you ideas. They can bring new people to you. There's lots of ways people can help you achieve your goals. The third question, that's sort of what we're going to dig into today, is why would they do that, right? With every, particularly people who are engaged in causes, I'm sure all of us, our inboxes are full with appeals, right, to our time and our energy and our money from all sorts of sources. The average American today is hit by at least 400 advertising messages every single day, just by advertisers, right? So we have to get kind of real about, why are they going to respond to me? Here's the Ford Foundation's message when we started. They said they're a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. That was their tagline. So when you develop a message for your organization, you want it to do two things for you. You want it to be motivating, get people interested. You want it to be what the marketing people call differentiating. It sets you apart. You're unique. Stand apart from others. So for a foundation, this is obviously kind of neither, right? All it says is, we give out money. Notice that's a functional message. That's what they do. Every foundation does that. Doesn't set them apart. Almost every foundation says they're innovative. It's a very common buzzword. Notice another thing. The message is about the foundation. It's not about their audience. What they want, Ford wanted to change that. They said, we want our audience to see themselves in our brand. So here's the new message. If you listen to NPR regularly, you've probably heard it about 100 times. Ford works with visionaries on the front lines of social change. This message puts the people front and center. It speaks to their aspiration of being visionary, of seeing a better future. I forgot to tell you, so how did Ford answer those three questions, right? Who's their audience? What can they do? Their audience was their grantees and potential grantees. What can they do? They wanted them to bring the new transformational idea, right, that's going to make big change happen, social change. That's what they wanted. And why would they do that? We do a lot of research for foundations, and of course the obvious answer, well, of course they want their money, right? But we found that people see a lot, there's a lot of benefit that people get from foundations. That money represents hope that something can actually happen. That's what resources mean. Foundations convene people. They bring people together who often work in isolation. They make you feel part of something bigger. See all those things going on? So they wanted their grantees to get those sorts of feelings from the foundation. So on the front lines differentiates Ford from other foundations. Ford's history, one, is of being on the front lines of social movements, of supporting them in their early days, like the women's movement here, the civil rights movement here, the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa. It's true to their history. That's another thing about this stuff. It has to be true. And it sets them apart. Also on the front lines, we're going to talk about the power of language in a little bit. That's a metaphor. It's evocative language, creates an image, creates emotional reaction. Why? It's a metaphor of battle, right? People on the front lines, they're at the sharp point of the spear. They're out there taking risks. That's exactly true with this. And funding social movements like that, they are. They're often, and it literally often does involve a battle. Look at this. Those are people on the front lines. This is from Ford's annual report when they rolled out this new message, and they used evocative images like this. That's the March on Selma. They were literally going into a battle with the Alabama State Police. And they use great images like this to evoke their history and connect their grantees to that legacy. That's meaningful communication. Let's look at another nonprofit based here in the Bay Area, REDF, is Robert's Enterprise Development Fund. Smart people with a business background using business approaches to create social enterprises that employ the hardest to employ people, people who have been in jail, chronically homeless, that sort of thing. They asked us to help with them on a new approach to communication. So let's look in a little more in depth what was the message that they had. This was a key message about how they do it. REDF has long been a leader in an outcome-based approach to philanthropy. Its core values include transparency, accountability, and a commitment to maximizing the social returns on its investments. Does that sound kind of familiar? That sort of tone? That's nonprofit speak. It's not unique, right? Everybody says they're results-driven. We're results-driven. We're outcome-based, blah, blah, blah. Everybody says that. Of course you are. It's not aspirational. These values words, transparency, accountability, those are important ideas, absolutely. But understand, the words aren't inspirational. And there's a difference between the idea and the word used to communicate it. You can have an awesome idea and you can talk about it in five different languages, right? We're going to talk about the difference. What are the ideas that motivate people, and then what's the language you use to do that? This kind of language, I think, happens when you're trying to show your expertise, which of course you need to do. That's not crazy. But you end up using an expert vocabulary that can just not connect with the non-experts in your audience. And this is a common trap we fall into when we're taught a lexicon, right? A lexicon's a specialized vocabulary. You go to school to learn it. It takes a lot of work to learn how to talk like a social scientist or a lawyer or whatever. Not the other people haven't done that, and you're not going to connect with them if you use your specialized language. I think it also comes from a phenomenon I call follow the funder. Right, so you're a smart nonprofit executive. You know where your bread is buttered, right? So you try to talk like those foundation funders do. That's strategic. It's not, you know, that's not crazy, but it tends to this sort of stuff. Foundations, God knows, speaking a language all their own. It tends to be a very academic-y sort of thing. You don't want that to be your message to the world. I'm here to tell you. So keep the funder speak in your foundation proposals and use real language to speak to other people. I say this to foundations too. They know they need to hear it. The people of REDF took these lessons that we're talking about today to heart. And when you go to the website now, you see a whole new way of communicating. Now REDF tells inspiring stories. This is a story of impact on a person's life, told in two lines, by the way. Of course, you can click through and read the story. That's one way to enter a conversation. That's kind of what we're talking about here. We're talking about how to enter a conversation with people who are new, right? New to you. How do you expand your circles? You start by doing things like this that hit them in the heart as well as the head. When you inspire and engage them like this, they'll want to learn more about it. They'll want to hear all about your return on investment, right? But you have to make that emotional connection first for them to get into it. So REDF credits this approach with engaging new people in the work, giving them more reach and resources to help them create jobs for more people, and that's what it's all about. As Michael said, it's communications for impact, not self-promotion. So let's look under the hood now and see what's happening. Why does this style of communication work? We're going to talk about theories from psychology that are helpful, I think, for you to understand as a leader and communicator. Now, I'm not a psychologist. I haven't even played one on TV. I do this political punditry stuff, that's it. We draw on psychological studies and we partner with psychologists to do our work. We'll work with psychologists who specialize in emotion or certain social groups, that sort of thing. If you're interested in learning more, this is a very good book for us lay people. It's from a Nobel Prize winning psychologist. It's on the reading list of a lot of smart leaders in business and philanthropy. Covers classic theories, interesting study, it's very accessible. I'm going to talk about some theories from this today. Here's one of the, so by the way, that's called Thinking Fast and Slow. Here's one of the first fundamental lessons you learn in that book. There are two mental processes that work together to drive decision-making behavior in human beings. There's the intuitive system and the cognitive system. So the intuitive system dominates our mental processes. It's the system of first impressions, emotional reactions, gut responses. It kicks in automatically in response to a new stimuli or situation. When I walked up here, your intuitive system, you don't want to admit it, judged me instantly, sized me up. In its way. That's your intuitive system kicking in. The intuitive system doesn't take energy from us. It's very easy. That's why this picture of the man under intuition, his face is relaxed. It doesn't take any mental effort, your intuitive system. The cognitive system is another story. Now, the cognitive is what we think of as thinking, reasoning, seeking information, weighing alternatives, making calculations. It kicks in after intuition. We use it much less often. Most people believe we're guided by reason, right? But intuition and emotion actually dominate most of our emotional processes. If you literally had to stop and think through everything to get through your day, you're just not going to get very far, right? Cognition comes into play when we need to think through something. Why is that? Because cognition requires attention, focused attention, and effort that drains us of mental energy. Now, the energy you use for mental, emotional, and physical activity all comes from the same source. It's the glucose in your bloodstream. The brain is the biggest use of it, user of it in your body. That's why you're supposed to eat good breakfast before you go to work, right? We are designed not to use that energy. We're designed to conserve it. It's a survival mechanism. So we literally are programmed not to stop and think about things too much. This guy under cognition, that's a picture of what the psychologists call cognitive strain. He's like struggling to think about something. So in fact, mental tasks like that are demotivating. People will stop focusing, lose attention within about 10 minutes. So you really have to care about an issue to stop and think about it. That's why we have to speak to the head as well as the heart, and speak to the heart first, I think is what I'm getting at here. So let's picture this. Picture yourself walking down a street, going somewhere you go all the time. Maybe it's to work, maybe it's to a store. You know the way, you don't have to think about it. You're thinking about what you have to do that day. That's your intuition at work, right? Walking down that street. Somebody asks, while you're doing that, what's 2 times 5? The answer just popped in your head, right? Intuition again, no mental effort, there's the answer. Now you learn that through brute repetition when you're what, 4th grade? Brutal repetition, you got that in your brain and today it comes up with no mental effort, good for you, that's intuition. Now picture yourself walking down that same street, 12 times 15, right? Most of us literally have to stop walking and think about that. It's true, I just added one number to either digit. This is what it means. People cannot do that calculation without literally stopping and thinking it through. That's what you're making people do when you're asking them to think too much. Sorry to say, but that is how we are wired. So people aren't going to stop and think about your cause, your organization, unless they care enough to spend that time to do it. So we have to speak to their heart and their head. Let's look at how we do that. Here's another a big idea from psychology that's going to help us do that. Our minds make sense of situations by creating stories. This lesson is fundamental to the approach that we take to connect with people at those multiple levels we talked about. And some of us were talking at lunch, storytelling is this hot topic. There's a lot of ways to talk about it. We're going to talk about a very particular way today, as you'll see as I unpack this. Here's a quote from that book, Thinking Fast and Slow. The mind appears to have a special aptitude for the construction and interpretation of stories about active agents who have personalities, habits, and abilities. You literally picture people and create stories. Your mind is searching for coherence, to make coherence out of the chaos of our world. And it makes stuff up to do that. Why are stories so powerful? Why does that happen? Why do we use that to find coherence in the world? Because that's the way human beings have been doing it since we had the capacity for language. Thank you very much. We've been doing it for a long time. Also, we as individuals, it's how we learn our language, it's how we learn our values, it's how we learn how the world works, is through stories we are told. So stories are just tales you tell your kids at bedtime, right? We use them all the time, lots of different ways. Think of business case studies, right? That's how Harvard Business School teaches its students. These are all examples of stories. Narrative allows you actually to communicate greater complexity than facts and figures alone do. You can learn cause and effect relationships, for example, a series of actions leading to consequences, right? That's actually more complexity than, let me tell you, give you a stat. We take a very systematic approach to storytelling that gives you a framework that you can use and adapt it for multiple purposes. Here it is. From Homer to Shakespeare to Hollywood, there's a basic narrative structure is what this says. It involves a protagonist trying to reach a goal, has to overcome an obstacle. That might sound familiar. In Hollywood, where they know something about stories, and they make billions of dollars telling us stories, they actually have a book of formulas. Yes, those are formulas. Those movies are all right out of the playbook. One of them is, they have different variations on the structure. One of them has a helper figure who helps the protagonist get over the obstacles. So think like Yoda to Luke Skywalker, right? Fairy godmother to Cinderella. The way we use this is you want to put your audience, the people, the story isn't about you, right? It's about the people you serve, the people you want to get involved, your audience. They're the protagonist. The goals is their hopes and values, their aspirations. Why is that? Because if you start there, you're going to start with what is actually meaningful to them. You're not coming from out of the blue. Then you get to start defining the problem. What gets in the way of them achieving what they want to in their life? And your solutions, how do you help them do that? That's why this has motivating power. This structure has actually been studied in psychology to have the maximum motivating power. We've heard a lot over the years about the power of positive thinking. You know that one, like the track coach says, picture yourself crossing that finish line, right? What the study shows is that actually that demotivates you if that's all you do, because your brain has actually experienced the emotional benefit of crossing the finish line. It can demotivate you. You have to know what it involves. What are the steps? What is the challenge? What does it take to get there? You need both of those things. That's maximum motivating power. Now, as we said, this is all about achieving impact. So the fourth element you need is a call to action. Now, call to action, we're going to talk about more detail, but that's about having a statement that actually gets people over that hump. We were talking at lunch too about how difficult it is to get people to take action. You have to have a good one to get people to do it. So we're going to walk through this structure one step at a time, and you'll have a chance to make notes in your book in those sections. As we go through each element of it, I'm going to show you examples of how we applied this approach to this project. Now, a major foundation asked us to help develop a narrative that would encourage the American people to support an active government role in helping people out of poverty and in the middle class. If you follow politics at all, you know the American people are not too excited about the government doing anything. Much less, unfortunately, welfare, right? This is a tough nut to crack. But we did it. Using this approach, we developed a narrative about this topic that gets 70% of Americans consistently to say, yes, the government should do that. So I'm going to show you how we, in each case, I'm going to show you how we did that, as hopefully as food for thought for you. People who work on these issues, on poverty issues in Washington, have been very interested in this. We've been briefing people at the White House, the federal agencies, in Congress, frontline organizations. I think it's really going to start to take off. So I'll keep coming back to this example. So rule number one, here's the first section, the people. Rule number one in aspirational communication is put people in the picture and do it the right way. I think you usually are going to need a message about two, maybe three groups of people. The people who are engaged in your cause. Think about it, the people of your organization, the people who support it, right? Remember I talked about social proof, people are looking, if they're thinking about your organization or issue, they're going to wonder, well, who supports that? That's one of the first things they think about. You need to have a message about that, a good one. The people you need to persuade, right? You need to speak to your audience, not about them in the abstract. You need to talk to them. You need to understand who they are and talk to them as people. You need a message about the people you're trying to persuade. There's two groups there. And if you work on an issue like poverty, where the people you serve might be yet another group, might be different from these, you need a smart message about them too. So we're looking for messages about people that create connections between different groups of people. So the poverty message is a great example for this. What's the best way? I'll just show you that in a second. With that, we had to do the people who are served by government anti-poverty programs, the policymakers who we wanted to support those programs, and the taxpayers and voters who they answer to. Those can be very different groups of people. We wanted everybody to see something in this message that spoke to them. So what's the best way to talk about people involved in your organization? Here's a hint from psychology. There's another theory. Our judgments are more influenced by liking or disliking than by reasoning. So this is what I call the I'll vote for George Bush because I'd like to have a beer with him effect. Right? Liking somebody, if you heard that, if you follow the political punch, you remember that was the thing. Oh, Bush, yeah, you'd rather have a beer with Bush. Sure, that's great. But just understand that liking somebody doesn't say whether they're competent or whatever, right? But we ascribe those attributes to somebody we like. If you like somebody first, then you're more likely to say they're trustworthy and competent and all those nice things. That's also called the halo effect. So what does that mean for your cause? You need to put a likable human face on your cause or on your organization. What is an organization after all, if not a group of people? The group of the people go away, there's no organization there. But too many nonprofits hide their people. All they do is talk about programs in the abstract, and that is abstract, by the way. Programs are people doing things for other people. Talk about them that way. So you need a message about staff, volunteers, donors, anybody who supports the cause. If your audience thinks that your people are cool or smart or committed, whatever it is, they're more likely to want to get involved and help. In terms of the populations we serve, if they're different, we have to go for empathy or respect for people. These are all different ways to talk about liking. The trick is to find a way to do it that enables all your audiences to see it. Now, one power to see themselves in it, to cross those social divides. Now, one powerful way to do that is to describe people in terms of their aspirations, in terms of their hopes and their values and what they're trying to achieve in life. I'm going to show you the poverty example. It becomes very obvious. Not in terms of demographic categories and things like that, which by definition create differences between people and start to put them in categories. And in fact, you start separating people. So this is a powerful insight. You want to get to a higher level talking about people in terms of more universal ideas that everybody can see themselves in. No matter if you're sitting in this room or you're a single mom trying to get your kids, you know, through a tough situation, you have very common ideas. If you, for example, are a parent and you want your kids to succeed in life, doesn't matter what demographic category you're in, what country you're in, wanting your kids to succeed in life, that's a universal aspiration. See that? That sort of idea. Talk about people that way. So let's look at this example from poverty. What we did here was research. We studied different stories. With the responsibility of a family, David worked hard to become self-sufficient and save for his children's future. So that sets up the story of an individual who is trying to stand on his own two feet and get ahead. What this goes on to say is he took classes in money management from a financial education program offered by the government. He opened an account, put away some money. It was matched, got matching funds from a program from the government. He was able to save money for a house. He got a tax write-off, mortgage write-off, that sort of thing. This is the story of somebody taking initiative, getting help from the government. I want to take a moment to talk about the difference between narrative. Remember I talked about that narrative structure and a story like this? That narrative structure, as we populate, is going to create a framework. In the literature, it's called a meta-narrative. It's an overarching framework that has universal ideas in it versus stories of individuals in specific situations, like a David. You tell stories that communicate ideas in that meta-narrative. That's the difference we're talking about here between this narrative structure. One thing we're talking about at lunch, too, was sort of the foundations are kind of getting sick of stories because you're bombarded with stories of so-and-so did this, and so-and-so did that, and so-and-so did the other thing. Those stories are good because they create those emotional reactions we're looking for, but they have to fit in a larger framework that puts the individual story and connects it to bigger social issues, right? You have to connect the dot between David and the government helping people in poverty. See that? You need both levels for your stories of individuals to actually create that impact, the more social impact, broader impact that you're talking about. So look how people reacted to this. This is what we actually test different stories. There's different ways to tell stories. You can actually shoot yourself in the foot by telling them wrong. This is a story of a man taking initiative with help from the government, and people respect those who take action, who roll up their sleeves, right? Get down to work, right? These are things we talk about. Say we respect people who do that sort of thing. This was one of the most important ideas that we had to encourage people to support a government role. See the big idea there? We talked about the difference between idea and the words used to communicate them. The big idea is tell stories of people taking initiative if you want people to get the government to help them. Then how do we talk, what's the language we use to do that? We suggested that people use words like these. This says create positive associations. That's a phrase from psychology. The first thing you say about somebody creates a chain reaction of ideas. That first impression you make is absolutely critical. It's very hard to undo them. What we suggest when you're working in poverty is you talk about the people that you serve using words like these that are all action verbs that show them taking initiative, doing something. They're hardworking. They're striving to stand on their own two feet. They're struggling to get ahead. All these phrases work to communicate that idea. Unfortunately, a lot of experts in the field talk about people very differently, using words like these that can create negative associations. According to the World Value Survey, about 60% of Americans associate the word poor with the word lazy. Right? That's not fair, but that's the way it is. And you need to understand dynamics like this, or you can shoot yourself in the foot right off the bat by using words that create negative associations. These euphemisms do the same sort of thing. It's very, very important that we do that. We want to create connections, not obstacles. Now, a picture is worth 1,000 words. We have to get the words right. We have to get pictures right. So this image came from an analysis we did for a client, nonprofit client, comparing their image and your brand. We use that term brand. There's lots of ways people use that. Essentially, your brand is the impressions you create in other people in your audience with the language you use to describe your work, the images you show them, which is often the first thing they encounter, and the experience they have with you when they interact with you. What's it like being involved with your organization? Those three things build your brand. So we always look at the images. So this was the dominant image. We look at what's the first thing people see when they go to this organization. They saw this. Now it shows people in distress. They need help. It's obviously designed to create an emotional reaction. Smart, right? But the most likely reaction is pity, right? Now, how many people like to be pitied? It's a negative emotion. This is important. It's going to start to create a negative association with the organization, right? And with all the time, all the options people have, like online, right, and all the way we're bombarded to go look online and stuff, who actually goes to look at pictures that make them sad, right? This is important to dynamic. Again, this isn't saying don't shine a light on problems, but you have to do it the right way. And remember, too, that emotional responses, that's what they're doing here. It's a very common thing. Make people feel sorry for the people, and then they'll give us money to help them. Of course, that's not crazy at all. But those emotional responses are short-lived. When people typically want bad, negative emotions like sadness to go away. So they may respond to make it go away, but they're not likely to come back for more. So that's an important thing, too. You want to engage people in a relationship. You don't just try and get their money out of them, say, ha-ha, thank you very much. Then go get them the next time, right? You want to try to relationship with them. That's one of the differences between having goals that you are working to achieve and just trying to push emotional buttons with people. So guess what? Remember, this was part of an analysis of three organizations. You want images that are motivating and, what I say, differentiating, that set you apart. Well, look at the other organizations. That was one of them there. That was another one there. Three different organizations, all trying to tug at our heartstrings with pictures of weeping people. Now, don't get me wrong. That doesn't mean you don't shine a light on the spot. Don't shine a spotlight on the human impact of the problems you address. You want to do that. So that's a smart thing to do here. But you do it in the right place. You do it when you're trying to educate them about the problem. I would recommend you not make it the dominant image about your organization. You want to use more aspirational images. You don't want to start here. It doesn't always help the people you serve to show them as victims either. Here's another approach. That's back at the Ford Foundation. A boy living in poverty. That's a township in South Africa. Now look at the dignity in him. Right? You can't help but root for him. It's like that story of David that we were talking about, trying to stand on his own two feet. You don't necessarily feel sorry for him, right? But you're going to get that response that you're looking for. You want to help that kid succeed. See the difference there? So it's about being strategic about emotional appeals and how you use people. So I've given you some food for thought about how to talk about the people involved in your cause. So now that your wheels are turning a little bit, look at your book. You've got some space to write there. Let's think about it. Apply it to your organization. Open it to that page. Take a minute to think about the people. Think about the people of your organization. Remember, there's a number of them you can think about. I'd sort of step back, try to think big. Like, think about the people who care about the cause that you work on. What are they like? What are they like as people? Think of adjectives that describe them. You could use words or phrases, whatever comes to mind, but think of them as people first. I'm going to give you a minute to do that. Okay, let's hear some. Let's just shout it out. Let's see what people are coming up with when you think about your folks as people. Who wants to just shout one out? Compassionate. How many people have compassionate? People who think of themselves as compassionate, if they start to see compassion in your message and your people, they're going to say, oh, that's like me. Who else? Who's got the other ones?
Local.
Local? Well, that's interesting. Yeah, what were you thinking there with the local?
The donors are very proud to be supporting their local organization.
Yep. So think of that, right? So our audience is people who are invested in our community. See how that suddenly like, oh, okay, yeah, that's our people. They may be interested in all sorts of issues, but that's something community activists, we actually had a candidate running for an office, and that's who he was like, yeah, I want the people who really care about their community, which is not everybody. That's a distinct market segment is what the marketers would call that. Who's got another one? Empathy? Yep. People who feel care about other people. Absolutely. Global, that's interesting. So say something about that.
So people who come away, they identify themselves, they travel a lot, they go to places other people don't go.
Yep.
When they go to countries, they go to places, yep. Capital.
Absolutely. I'm one of those people. I was a foreign correspondent, I've been to 34, 35. You say that, I'm like, yeah, that's me. And it's not my brother. Who's right, hasn't moved out of our hometown. We're just very different people. But see how you're already thinking strategically about appealing to them in a new way, right? Not just, we have this program and it does this and it does that and it does the other thing and you should like it because it's helping these other people. They say, no, that's an organization of people who have a global mindset. Yeah, that's me. See how that works? One more.
Goal-driven.
Goal-driven, what was this?
Childlike.
Childlike, that's an interesting. Oh, that's, yep. So childlike, wonder, fun. Now, you're the sort of person that the marketing experts want to work with because your organization is going to have personality, right? So the way that would work, say, okay, does this event we're putting on, is it fun? We had an organization, nonprofit organization, working on a tough campaign. It took 5 years to achieve our goal. And their members started getting kind of sick of all the emails, right? So we did focus groups with them. They were having what we call attrition, right? Their response rate started to drop off. We sat down with their members, said, hey, what's wrong? Why aren't, you know, they're like, well, it used to be fun. Now it's all, we have to, you know, the Huns are coming over the hill, we have to go battle them, right? They got the tone wrong. And that wasn't hard for this organization. Like, all right, cool, we can be fun, no problem, right? Every event after that was fun, right? They made it fun to achieve the goal. Yeah, come on, we're like creating social change here, people. Let's have some fun with it, right? That turned the whole thing around. The people also had to know, however, they had to have information. They had to know how close they were to the goal. I'm going to show you an example of that later. So see how your personality of the organization starts to come out when you think about the people of the organization? I'm hoping, is this opening some new avenues for how to think about how to communicate? Great. Okay. Let's move on to the next thing, your goals. How many of you read a recent article in SSIR that was called When Good Isn't Good Enough? That was a great piece. I've recommended that to many people in high places. A fascinating piece by the leaders of two very sophisticated nonprofits, Share Our Strength and Kaboom. They wanted to get beyond alleviating problems like hunger and childhood obesity and start eliminating, right, the causes of them. In that article, they outlined the steps they took to start to achieve that kind of transformational change. And they said the first and most important goal step was to set an ambitious but achievable goal. That's the first step. Why is that? I mean, on one hand, it's kind of obvious. To go big, you gotta think big, right? But understand, it's the very bigness of the goal that gives it motivating power, right? How many of you really are inspired to give up your time and energy and your resources to maintain the status quo, right? It's not what we're in the business of, right? You want to excite and inspire people, set exciting, inspiring goals. It's not rocket science, and I get it, and as they lay out in the article, it gets scary, like, oh no, we can't achieve that. It has to be achievable. You know what, maybe it's a risky one. Maybe it's going to be hard to achieve, how about that? Remember the motivating power of having an inspirational goal and telling people how hard it is and going to be to achieve it? That's motivating. So I thought that was a really, and then they go in to talk about a number of things that are really going to click as we talk through this, just the steps of trying to create transformational change. So here's a way to start think about setting goals that motivate people. This is also from psychology. If you took Psych 101, it's probably familiar. This is a simplified version of a classic model for motivational psychology. It's called the hierarchy of needs. It says that people are motivated first and foremost, look at the bottom, it says basic needs, physical needs, sense of security. That's where you're motivated first. Those are meeting physiological needs for survival, right? You have to have food on the table, roof over your head, before you're gonna be thinking about anything else, right? You need a sense of security. We're highly motivated to take action against things that cause us worry, right? So those are the basics. One of the challenges I have working with Democrats is that all we ever want to talk about. Safety nets, right? Food on the table, roof over your head. It's important, of course. And in this day and age when people are struggling, absolutely. But remember, even people who are struggling to get the basics together, they're also thinking about bigger and better things too. And so are there people who aren't struggling on the basics. So you limit your appeal if you're just hitting at one level of this. So then there's the psychological needs. This says belonging. We want to be part of a family, part of a social group. We want to be part of something, right? These are human motivations. Esteem, we want to feel good about ourselves, right? We want others to think well of us. We do things or don't do things because we're afraid what people will think of us, right? That's a motivator. The highest level, once we're safe and secure, we feel good about ourselves and fit in, that's when we're hitting the money, and it's called self-actualization, right? You are really, that's when you feel fulfilled with your life. That is defined as fulfilling your individual potential. That's using your unique talents and abilities in your life, right? You're not just doing a job, you're doing a job you love. You know, you aspire to do a job you love, right? That's what that's talking about. These are powerful drives that are in everybody, even people who are just struggling to meet the basics, have all of these drives. So depending on the work you do, your nonprofit has something to offer people at all of these levels, right? If you're serving people struggling to get out of poverty, obviously you're helping them meet their basic needs. But the people who are helping you do that, right, the people who have money to invest over, they're looking for fulfillment in their lives. See that? Talk to them as well as the people that you're serving and understand they're motivated differently. So how do we apply this kind of thinking to setting goals? Let's use an example of one of the world's great nonprofit brands. This is CARE. They work, humanitarian organization, one of the largest in the world, work on the ground around the world. They help in humanitarian crisis. CARE was started in World War II by American volunteers who made care packages of food and clothes to send to refugees in Europe. And that's where the term care package comes from. Unfortunately, they didn't get the trademark on that. So today they work on the foundations of development, not just helping people in crisis, but education, healthcare, economic opportunity that helps people stand on their own 2 feet. And their core strategy is to empower women. That's where you get the biggest bang for your buck in international development if you're investing in women, because you get more results from that. So that's one type of goal we see in the sector is to alleviate suffering. And this is the sort of image or message that you get. Right? The goal is to meet the basic needs for food and shelter of this family, right? Of course, that's absolutely necessary. In fact, when there's a famine, CARE's donations go through the roof. They're very good at shining a spotlight on the need. Remember, I didn't say don't do it. I just said do it in the right way, at the right time. They shine a spotlight on needs like this, their donations shoot up. And then guess what happens? Then they shoot right back down, right? People have responded to made an emotional reaction. But they've also heard that this is a crisis, this is a short-term need, so naturally they're not going to come back until the next crisis shows up, right? But that's not a particularly sustainable revenue model, right? So CARE does this too. This is a campaign we created to help CARE promote their microfinance program for women, right? Again, you can't help but like them, look at that, right? You want to help them. They're excited, they're doing powerful things. And it begins by envisioning and articulating an inspiring goal, not just feeding and housing them, but helping them become entrepreneurs. See the difference? That's a more aspirational goal. They can then feed and house their families and do all the great things that entrepreneurs want to do. I keep going back to lunch conversation, but you know, at lunch we were talking about the millennial generation, largest generation in history, most diverse generation in history. One of their core values is to live a life with purpose. They're a great market for you. But one of the things that really animates them is entrepreneurial activity, making a difference in the world by creating that awesome app or creating a business, right? They think they're going to be the next billionaire with a B, right? But this idea of, I just throw that out there, social enterprise, entrepreneurial activity, very exciting to them. They see purpose in that. this kind of goal, this is more likely to keep people engaged over time than the previous one, right? Where you're just trying to make the bad feeling go away or help with a crisis, then don't go away. Kiva.org is a good example for this, right? You see people in developing country, you're giving money to help them achieve a goal and you follow the story. So one rule of thumb for setting and articulating goals with more motivating power is to think bigger, as I said. Set goals that are achievable, but also aspirational. And let's look at the example I mentioned about our narrative about poverty in America. It suggests a second rule. First rule is think big. Here's the second rule, be specific. So we tested goal statements about the government's role in poverty. Here's a simple one. Government should have a role in helping people to become financially secure. That's the goal, helping them be financially secure. Right off the bat, over half of people say, yeah, sure, government should do that. It's a very simple statement of a goal. Look at this one. Would you favor or oppose government implementing policies that help American families build savings and other financial resources in order to achieve financial security? Notice how people are starting to show up, families. And we're just being a little more specific, these functional things we're talking about, savings. We jump up 12 more points, and we lose 10 points in opposition. When you start talking about government doing things, people are opposed to it. You often start out there, but look what's happening here. You're cutting into the group of people who sort of reflexively don't want government to do anything. This is just being a little more specific. Now, financial security is a meaningful goal to people. We all want that, but it's kind of abstract. Those are abstract words. When I say abstract, I mean something very particular. It means it doesn't bring up an image in your mind versus the word vivid. Vivid language, vivid means it creates mental images. You can see something. So it's hard to see financial security. So we always go the next step down and we ask people, well, how do you envision, when somebody says financial security, what do you see? They see themselves in a job that pays enough money to do three very specific things: buy a house, send their kids to college, save for retirement. Those are the four specifics. They're all tangible. This is literally how Americans define getting out of poverty. It's literally how they define financial security. It's how they define being in the middle class. It's that checklist of four very tangible things. So that's the second rule, setting goals. Get the specific in there. Those aren't big complicated statements by any means. So let's take a minute and apply that thinking. Think about your goal for your organization. I'm sure you have a lot of them. Try this. Try to write down the most exciting, inspiring goal that you're trying to achieve. Think about that. And after you've nailed that perfectly, then list a couple specific tangible benefits is the word we use for this. So what is the benefit to people if we achieve this goal? What are those specific things? I say, what do they get? I think I'm going to give you 2 minutes on that one because that's harder. Okay, let's check the time, and I'm going to go into fast-talking consultant mode right now. Because we're going to get through this, or we're going to get through it on time. It's the most important thing a speaker can do. And again, this is to give you food for thought. I'm happy to chat with folks afterward about the ideas you have, that sort of thing. So you've talked about the goals. Now let's go to the problem. We talk about the people, the goals. If you get those two parts of your narrative right, now you're ready to start identifying the problem that you're addressing. You're speaking to people about things that are meaningful in their lives already, and now, okay, fit your issue into the picture there. You get to define the problem that stands in the way. You get to connect their hopes and values to your work. Now you probably address complex issues, I'm sure you do. When you're the expert, you understand the complexities. Right? You want others to understand them. But remember, we can't ask people to stop and think at the very beginning of this process. We have to pull them in one step at a time. You have to make it easy for people who aren't experts to understand the problem. I know this is a challenge. Set a high bar for them. You want them to understand it intuitively. That means instantly. Okay? I know everybody's, what? Right? You work in complex issues, but I'm going to help you with that. Why is that so important? We said that complexity demotivates people. Here's the psychological theory at work here. There's two of them. This one's called fluency theory. People are more likely to trust information they readily understand, right? If you understand something intuitively, easily, it actually makes you feel good and you're more likely to trust what you're being told. If it's complex and you're wrinkling your brow, suddenly they're trying to pull the wool over your eyes or you have to read the fine print. See that? complexity actually breeds suspicion. It's people start to back off, or use that starts to demotivate people in a couple ways. That's one of them. It's they're less likely to trust you. This goes with the words you use. If you use words they don't know, if the ideas are too complex, even visual displays of information. If it's confusing, if the text is hard to read, they literally trust less what's on the paper. Very important thing. So that's why I say it's smart to dumb things down. That's being facetious, right? Making things simple isn't trying to dumb it down and get all the complexities out. You're just trying to start in a place where people will understand. So think of Albert Einstein, right? He nailed the theory of the universe in a little formula, right? Equals mc squared. Now, I know there's a lot behind that formula. I couldn't explain it. But that's a smart way to get people to start to think about the problem. See that? Make it simple at the beginning. There's a related theory to fluency. Remember, fluency says if you understand it intuitively, you trust it. There's another one. It says anything that taxes your working memory makes it harder to think. So your working memory is that super short-term memory that held the words at the beginning of the sentence that I am speaking in your mind so that you could reach the end of it and understand the thought I'm trying to communicate to you, right? So along that path, if I introduce some jargon, anybody use jargon in their speaking about their work? If I introduce a word you don't know, your working memory stops right there and runs off and tries to look it up. And you literally don't hear what comes after it, and you miss the whole point. You miss the idea. See how that works? Eradicate jargon from your communications. Enough said. There's another thing that experts like to do is data. We want everybody to understand all the available data, and we spend a lot of money gathering this data, and damn it, you're going to hear about it, right? And if you understand all this data, you're going to understand this problem and how we need to fix it, right? Beware the dangers of data. The same sort of thing happens. Remember the 12 times 15, you had to stop walking, right? That's taxing your working memory. You're making it hard for people. Don't start with a bunch of data. I'm going to give you a powerful technique, though, for opening people's eyes without doing that. Remember, and also let me step back and make a point about this. There's an audience for everything. There's audiences for all that data. They're just not the people you're trying to say, hey, come get interested in this cause, right? They're the people who already get it. People want a bunch of data. Most people don't want a bunch of data. Here's the way to think about that. Use stats selectively and surprise people. Surprise is an emotional reaction. It focuses attention. Right? When you surprise people, you open their eyes in a new way. They're more likely to remember it. Remember an emotional reaction? They're going to notice it, and they're more likely to remember it and be motivated to take action. So here's data. Trust me, there's a lot of facts and figures about government programs that fight poverty, right? We looked at a lot of them. We actually start testing, and we test what's the one best data point to use with people, right? That opens their eyes in a meaningful way. Here's one. 9 out of 10 people who get help from the government either work or they can't work because they're disabled or elderly. Surprised? That's welfare, people. That's welfare in America, right? I think if American taxpayers understood that, and that in fact welfare is actually taxpayers subsidizing businesses that can or won't pay a living wage to people, right? You might change the whole dynamics on that. Thank you very much. So, take this moment. I'm serious about it. I preach that every time I give this. I'm like, you guys need people just to understand one fact, and it can change the whole way you think about something. So take a second now, a lightning round. What's the one fact? Now, it could be a stat. It could just be a statement of fact like this. I could say most people on welfare actually have jobs. There's a stat behind it. I didn't throw a number at you, right? Whatever it is, what pops to mind that you think would surprise people at your table that they didn't know about the problem that your organization addresses?
1 million people walk into California libraries every day.
Wow. People still go to libraries? That's what you're after, right? Exactly. And in fact, another one down those lines is millennials, those young people, 3 out of 5 say they read a newspaper. Things like, yeah?
I don't know the exact figure. I had it in my head at one point, but it costs X dollars per year to raise a child. Michigan's foster children receive less than half.
Yep. Nice. If you're surprising me with how much it costs to raise a child, that's helpful, right? Again, because you've got the emotional reaction. You said, oh, wow. I didn't know I was spending that much money on these brats, right? And then you go that. We're going to keep going because of the prime directive, Star Trek fans, the prime directive, finish on time. So that's fun you can have. Try to surprise each other with facts about your problem. In our research on poverty, we're taking a different tack here real quick. We wanted to ask people their belief about the cause of the problem. Understand what your audience thinks. Here's the information, right? In your opinion, which is generally more responsible if a person is poor? Lack of effort or lack of opportunity? Americans are kind of split on that, right? So strategically, what do we have to do when we define that problem? We got to get more people to understand it's about a lack of opportunity. So how do we do that? What's the idea? A lot of kids don't get an equal start in life. That's how we started to tell a story about lack of opportunity in America. That's the big idea. You can't blame the child for being born into a family that struggles to make ends meet. It shows they aren't at the same starting line as everybody else, so they don't have the same opportunity. So this is what an expert would call the intergenerational cycle of poverty, right? Don't get an equal start. Don't start at the same starting line. There's an important thing going on there with the language. That's a metaphor, okay? So what happens in your brain when I say something like that, all the kids, every kid doesn't start in the same place. What the MRI studies show, they study the electrical activity in your brain. Your language center fired up because you're hearing words and you're trying to understand them. There's a visual thing. Your visual center, you're not literally looking at kids, but your visual center kicked in and an image popped in your mind of kids lining up. There's motion there, they're getting in line. The center of your brain that deals with motor activity also fires when I said that sentence. So see all this stuff going on in your head? That's another reason metaphors work, right? They make your brain work. So we're doing things like this to get people to start to wrap their head around a problem. Makes it intuitive. Yeah, of course, not all kids start at the same line. Another insight from psychology, by the way, when you put children in the picture, evokes altruistic values in people. So yes, pull their heartstrings with kids in the picture. People can't help themselves. That message tested 72%. Right? That thing makes 72% of Americans say, yeah, the government should help that kid. Help that person, right? When you start by telling kids. This is President Obama taking some very good advice and doing that in his State of the Union speech, talking about a little girl born into the bleakest poverty, using those dynamics. So you've talked about your problem, now what about the solutions? It has to connect to solutions that make intuitive sense. So you need a simple, powerful message for your solution, just like your problem. So as the checklist, the last page of our section sort of explains this. We call these winning words. When you're getting down to the words that you're going to use, this is a simple checklist you can use. For a language to have maximum motivating power, people need to feel it, believe it, see it, and say it. I won't go back through these because we talked about the role of emotion. We've talked about fluency theory and believing something. That's about making it simple, actually. They'll believe it if it's simple. Using vivid images and metaphors, like I just said. But we also want people to say it. This goes back to what Julie was talking about, using social media. We want ideas, language, and language that people will retain and repeat to somebody else, so you get the power of word-of-mouth communication. And word-of-mouth has always been the most powerful form of communication. And in fact, now that we're bombarded and we have all these tools, it's actually more important. The studies have shown people are turning more and more to people they know for as sources of ideas and information. It's more important than the news media, it's more important than advertising, is people. So make your mess, make sure if you're, and well, that's a real litmus test for us. When we're testing a slogan or whatever it is, if somebody wouldn't actually say it to somebody else, go back to the drawing board. I want to show you a quick example of this from a great nonprofit we work with called Lyft, on the front lines fighting poverty in 6 countries across America. I've got 1 minute. Lyft. Inspirational leadership has really a smart, holistic theory for helping people do all the different things they need to get out of poverty, to address the intergenerational cycle of poverty. This is how they were talking about it. If clients receive support on internal and community dimensions, they will accelerate their economic gains and ultimately sustain them over time, right? Nonprofit speak. Using this winning word sort of approach, Lyft builds, there's an action verb, the strong personal, social, and financial foundations, that's a metaphor, that people need to lift themselves out of poverty for good. That's just another way to say we actually do a lot of things to help break that cycle. And then the personal, social, and financial foundations, it's like, okay, those are simple words but still abstract, so then they explain what they mean by those. This is capturing their theory in a really simple way. I wanted to show you the metaphor we came up with on the poverty message on the government's role. Government can give people tools that helps them work their way out of poverty. See that? A tool is a metaphor of empowerment. It's not a handout. When you're taking initiative and trying to do something, somebody can offer you a tool. There's two things going there. It's the empowerment piece, helping somebody who's taking initiative. It's also government offering options, not mandates, not forcing you to do something. People are very resistant to government mandates. And in fact, the government does not force you to take anti-poverty programs, right? That message, 75% of people support. What I did there was put all the building blocks that we've talked about, put the people in the picture, the specific goals, and then this metaphor of tools. 75% of Americans want the government to do that. This also from the State of the Union speech, this is a story from the New York Times previewing the State of the Union. Notice how tools pop there? That's that word of mouth thing. The reporter picked up on it and put it in the story. That's what we're looking for, that word of mouth potential in our language that we create. So you get to do the workbook exercise on your own time. Lastly, real quick, now we're going backwards in time. I'm going to go 2 minutes backwards in time right now. I'm going that fast. The call to action. So remember, you've got to have the call to action. This, and ultimately, okay, so we've done all this and we've spoken to people's heart and their head. They care already, okay? You have to give them something specific to do. Don't forget that. They have to have specific things they can do to help you. There's a whole body of work on how to engage people in activities that actually make a difference for you and are meaningful to them. We're not going into that. The way we define call to action is a message that creates a sense of urgency to act. You can do that in a couple ways. You can alarm them. Nonprofits are great at this, right? This is global warming, right? If you don't take action right now, right, this isn't about polar bears and ice caps. If we don't do something about this right now, it's gonna be in your backyard. And we work with lots of environmental organizations. Nothing against polar bears and ice caps, but if you work on climate change, you already got those people who care about polar bears and ice caps. The challenge there is to create a sense of urgency among people who think it's far in the future, or who don't think it's a problem at all, apparently. Here's another one. Create a sense of urgency. Don't necessarily go for alarm or negative things. Tell them about the possibilities of doing something awesome. This is another client of ours. This is a campaign to end polio. We are this close, people, to ending polio. If you do something right now, we can wipe out a disease that cripples and kills children in the world. See that? Cool, I wanna help you get over that finish line. See that? Another approach, still urgency. I wanna do this now, because we're that close. Malaria, we have another, it's another attack. If we don't stop malaria now, it's gonna come back. Can always come back. That's sort of mixing alarm in there. So those are a couple ways that you can use to create a sense of urgency. Putting it all together, we've got that narrative structure that tells you the ideas that you need to talk about, the language, the words. This is back to our poverty example. Then you can create just sort of a core, this is called core content, right? This is the big idea about our cause and our organization. We do a 1 minute message. We think and believe, and in fact you must, be able to explain just about anything in just about a minute in this day and age to start a conversation with someone. So that first line there in bold is what we call the elevator pitch. Now actually, on your call to action, I wish we could have had time for this exercise. So picture, for your call to action exercise, you're in an elevator, that's why they call it an elevator pitch, with Michael Bloomberg, right? He's leaving mayor, he's got $1 billion to spend on a cause, and it could be yours. Right? Think about that moment and creating a sense of urgency for on that elevator ride. What would you say to him to get a, you know, to get a shot at $1 billion? Try that out when you're doing your sense of urgency. So you can then put together a simple statement, brings it all together, that creates that overarching framework. Remember I talked about this, an overarching framework about this issue of government and poverty. That'll motivate people to take all kinds of actions on all kinds of policies. We just put two up here. But this is actually being used to frame dozens of programs and policies that people are working on throughout the government, throughout the country. And then also you can tell stories like David's stories, right? But if you do this first, David's story is going to fit into a larger context and somebody is more like, say, yes, I support the government helping do things like that to help people like that. See that? That's really what we've talked about today. Just for the fun of it, what we're doing here is trying to change the national dialogue on poverty. So we put together a manual like this and are painstakingly holding workshops and briefings with people who work on poverty and drive that national dialogue. We can actually map it, the words and language and ideas that break through in the news media and the social media, and we're going to try to change it to create a better climate for this.
So I hope you are able to do the same sort of thing. Now, we know not everybody's going to be Martin Luther King, but I hope you've got some ideas and some inspiration today that you can use in your work to be an inspiring leader and have an aspirational organization. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a presentation from the Stanford Discussion Series.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems.
To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
This is Chris Deigelmeyer
and Eric Nie on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.